hopes that come to be. And the people gather around. They are for all they can bring. And nobody win with that. Only let us all sing. The revolution starts now.
Good afternoon, Richmond. Welcome to Indie Media Live, one of the most progressive half hours on the radio, because we have no corporate sponsorship and no corporate control. I hope you'll stay tuned to hear what a difference that makes in bringing you the news. I'm your host, Rebecca Ferris, and I'm here every Tuesday introducing you to people in our community who are passionately involved in the issues and causes that directly affect you and your family. This is the show where Richmond comes to hear what democracy sounds like. We have an awesome show for you today. Kent Willis, the executive director of the ACLU of Virginia, is here, and we're going to be talking about all things constitutional. So I hope that you will stay with us. Kent is the, as I said, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia. He's been with that organization since 1987, and he's been the executive director of the Virginia chapter since 1989. That's a long run, Kent.
It's been a long time, but the ACLU takes on so many different issues that every day is different at the office.
Every day is different at the office. It is a great, great pleasure to have you in the house again. You have been a longtime supporter of WRIR. I think that you were one of the very first guests that anybody had on Alan Levenberg's show way back in the beginning.
Way back in the beginning, I did almost a regular appearance on one of your first shows, yes, and enjoyed it a great deal.
And Richmond Indie Media was also in the original lineup, so we are in our sixth year as well. So it's great to have you back here today. The American Civil Liberties Union is celebrating 91 years, I believe, this year. You guys were founded in 1920 after the Palmer Raids. Could you tell our listeners just a brief synopsis of what the Palmer Raids were?
There were a variety of issues that started the ACLU back around 1920. And basically, it was looking at the notion that you had First Amendment rights to express yourself, either through union organizing, taking to the streets to protest, or even publishing your views in newspapers. Believe it or not, while the Constitution had been in place for 100 and some years at the time, there was very little law related to the First Amendment. People were often just gathered up and put in jail, or demonstrations were broken up, and there wasn't much to protect them. The First Amendment was there, it was on the books, but it really had not been into the courts. The ACLU made up its mind that it wanted to get it before the Supreme Court, the question of what these fundamental rights really meant in terms of practice. And so we started by representing war protesters, demonstrators, and we even represented some of the individuals who were, believe it or not, arrested for in editorial pages expressing positions against World War I and later military actions. All of those things led to the formation of the ACLU, and since then it has been, to a large extent, a First Amendment group, protecting your right to assemble, to speech, practice your religion, separation of church and state, but also dealing, just as importantly, with the issue of equality under the law. The ACLU position is that the libertarian principle means that we all have these freedoms and that the government can't interfere with them, and they're all expressed there in the Constitution. But they don't mean anything unless they are applied equally to all people, regardless of race, religion, or national origin. And in that regard, we're a civil rights organization. So that sort of defines our mission, and it takes us from one side of the political spectrum to the other. If your free speech rights are being abridged, it doesn't matter if you're on the far left or the far right or anywhere in between, we're going to help you. I guess the point is this, is for particularly for free expression or even freedom of religion, if you are practicing within the mainstream, typically you get to express yourself. But if you're a little on the margins, that's when the government tends to oppress your views. So we kind of end up defending a lot of people on the margins.
Well, that was one of the myths that I wanted to bust today, that you are not on one side or the other. You are a nonpartisan organization. You are on the side of the Constitution.
Absolutely. And if you look at our cases, I mean, even here in Virginia, we've defended everyone from the KKK's right to demonstrate to people on the far left, to demonstrate as well. I mean, look at the recent issue here in the city of Richmond where we were represented May Day paraders in their right to not have, not penalties, but heavy expenses imposed on them before being involved in a parade in Richmond.
And I'm sure that people are aware of that case as well. Do we have a decision on that? I guess we did because of May the 1st.
Well, that was a case where we went to court the right of the May Day organizers not to have to pay a $295 fee to be involved in a parade in Richmond. Our argument was that the Richmond ordinance, there's no Richmond ordinance allowing the city to impose such a fine, but a cost on individuals. Our concern, of course, is that means that such costs could be imposed arbitrarily. That is, it's imposed if you don't like the group, but not imposed if you do. So our argument was the city of Richmond could not impose a cost on individuals unless it was written in the law that they could. We lost what was called the preliminary injunction, which was the initial round in court, although we agreed that the demonstrators could go ahead with their demonstration as long as they stayed on the sidewalk. So that's all happened now. But the issue is not over yet. Richmond still has an ordinance, parade ordinance, that does not say anything about imposing cost for having a parade or cost for police officers. Yet they seem to be doing it sometime. And so either the city needs to fix that or we'll continue litigating it.
If you've just tuned in, it's 20 minutes before the hour, and you're listening to Indie Media Live on WRIR. I'm your host, Rebecca Ferris, and my guest is Kent Willis, the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia, ACLUVA.org. There's a lot of information on your website and ways people can get involved, ways people can contact you if they feel that their rights have been compromised in some way. I wonder if we could go into some of the other issues and cases that you've been looking at. I'm most interested, first of all, in giving our listeners an update to what we talked about in October, the case of the global positioning satellite device, the GPS device, being put under the car, on the car of a Fairfax County, Virginia man. And I'm wondering if you can bring us up to date on that case. Or maybe give us a little bit of the history of it, and then bring us up to date.
This is a situation where the Fairfax County Police decided they wanted to follow someone. And the easiest way for them to do it, rather than getting in a car and driving around, was
old-fashioned surveillance.
Right, was to put one of these GPS tracking devices on the car of the individual. The question for us here is, do the police have a right to put a tracking device on your car? There's something called the Fourth Amendment, and as we know, that prevents the police from entering your home being involved in searches of private property in any way unless they first get a warrant from a magistrate. This is part of checks and balances. The police have certain powers, but before they exercise those powers, they have to check with the courts to make sure that they're not overreaching their constitutional limits. So the police here didn't bother to get a warrant. They simply went ahead and tracked this car. When the case went to court, the individual who was being tracked challenged the right of the police to do that, saying it violated the Fourth Amendment for them not to first get a warrant to do it. No one's saying the police necessarily couldn't have gotten a warrant. It's just that we want those checks and balances, particularly on law enforcement. The first round of the case went against us, and the court said it was perfectly fine for the police to do that. It then went to the Virginia Court of Appeals, and it did what courts often will do. It sort of punted on the big issue. It said, We're not saying whether the police have a right to do this or not, but in this particular case, and then it goes on into some technicality. So
without a warrant.
So what we have now actually is we're better off now than we were before. The first case went against us. The second one, the court punted on. But as long as the court is punting, it means that the Fairfax County Police, at least, and maybe other police departments, feel free to put these devices on cars. This is an important public policy issue. How far can the police go? What technologies can they use to follow you, invade your privacy, and the like? And, of course, because of advancements in technologies, this has been a big question in the courts in a variety of ways in recent years. What has to happen here, I think, is, or what should happen, is the Virginia General Assembly can fix this. They can pass a law saying it is unconstitutional or it is against the law in Virginia for police to put a tracking device on your car without your permission, without your knowing it, unless they first go to a magistrate judge and get a warrant. It's that simple. On the other hand, the Virginia General Assembly doesn't necessarily seem inclined to do something like that, so we'll just have to see.
I thought that maybe one of the wrinkles in this case is that the crime that this gentleman was accused of, it was sexual assault. And I know that that is such an egregious crime that maybe people tend to want to bend the Constitution and erode our rights just a little bit more because of the nature of that crime. It feels like that is also at play with this familial DNA testing. Virginia has just become the third state in the nation to implement the familial DNA program, in which law enforcement personnel are allowed to search the state's criminal DNA data bank, not only for matches from the crime scene evidence, but for indications that the criminal might have a relative who is in the data bank. Could you speak to that? This feels very slippery slope to me.
Yeah. This is part of this broad issue about what sort of brakes you're going to put on the technologies that keep getting developed. The tendency, let's face it, if you're in law enforcement, your goal is to catch crooks. And you're not going to be thinking about the fact that all of us, including crooks, have constitutional rights. So there's a tendency for police to sort of, for law enforcement to automatically embrace anything that looks like a good tool for fighting crime. And that's one of the things that seems to be happening with familial DNA testing. This is relatively new. It's only being used right now in three states. It recently came in the news because they used it in California to catch someone who had evaded the police, a serial killer who had evaded the police for 7 or 8 years. It is now in use in Virginia. And what it does allow that unnerves us is for the police to essentially create a suspect list because you are related to someone who has committed a crime. In other words, it takes these sort of unique circumstances. Someone has to have committed a crime and have their DNA in a database. A relative of that person may have committed another crime. So what the police do is look at the evidence from the crime scene and look to see if that person might be related to someone who's already in the database. Depending on how you do this, you could end up with a very large circle of suspects based solely on the fact that their DNA shows that they are related to someone who's committed a crime, not based on any other facts whatsoever. That sort of turns criminal investigations on their head. It's usually a highly individualized process where you start with individuals, you look for evidence, and you move from there. The way this is being used now, which is only according to the protocol adopted in Virginia and California and other states, in the most egregious crimes where the police have run into dead ends over years. That doesn't concern us so much, and it may be used effectively, although it's not going to happen very often if you think about the circumstances.
For serial rapists and that sort of.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it may work sometimes for those people. This is not a cure for crime. I mean, the circumstances it takes for this to work are going to be very rare, and it's only going to happen every once in a while. The concern is that the law enforcement, though, will somehow see this as a way to solve a lot of crime, start using it a lot, meaning what's going to happen is a lot of people are going to be targeted as suspects who have nothing, who have done nothing wrong, but they are related in some general way to someone who's committed a crime. One of the things to remember is that if you are targeted as a suspect in a crime and your employer finds out or relatives find out or whatever, there can be consequences. An employer thinks that you may have committed a crime because you're a suspect, there's nothing that prevents them from firing you. I don't know that employers would do that, but it's the sort of thing that worries us a great deal.
The law enforcement show up to question you or something, or at your home. Yeah, there are consequences.
And it's one thing if that happens because law enforcement has a specific reason to believe that you committed a crime. But if they're doing it simply because you are related to someone that's committed a crime, that rubs us the wrong way, and we are advocating against widespread use of this technique.
I am very interested in helping our listeners understand that you guys are involved with education. You are involved with legislation, as well as being involved with court cases. We are just wrapped up the 2011 General Assembly session, and we did a lot of shows on that here on Indie Media Live. And one of the scariest parts of what came out of the 2011 General Assembly session for me was the law requiring that abortion clinics come up to the standards of quote-unquote hospitals. In other words, with very wide hallways, with so many handicapped parking spots and these sorts of things, clearly intended to shut down abortion clinics. Could you talk to us about what you saw happening in the General Assembly?
This was a very disappointing turn of events that took place literally in the last moments
of the General Assembly.
Right. Mm-hmm. The General Assembly has tried to pass for a long time a bill that would regulate abortion clinics in the same way they regulate hospitals. There is no basis for that whatsoever. There's no data that shows that abortion clinics are not absolutely safe. Yet one of the ways anti-choice legislators have looked at sort of cutting into reproductive freedom is by making it basically too expensive for abortion clinics to operate and for people to get abortions. And this is one way they've done it. The bill to do this did not pass this year, as it has not passed for many years, but it ended up being an amendment to another bill at the last moment and just sort of shot right through the General Assembly without going through the committee process that usually blocks this bill. And what it did was it orders the Board of Health in Virginia to issue regulations that treat abortion clinics as a hospital. Now, there are different categories of hospitals, and there are different ways the Board of Health can do this. We don't know at this very moment exactly what they're going to do. The laws that were introduced just laid it out in the law. This has kicked it over to the Board of Health, and now we have to see what they're going to do. We're putting, along with a lot of other reproductive rights group, a large effort into lobbying that group to make sure it understands the consequences of what it's doing, and we want them to take the least restrictive action possible under the bill passed by the General Assembly.
And signed into law by the governor.
Absolutely.
I want to, you know, on its face, when you say, well, abortion clinics should be regulated like hospitals, well, of course. I mean, I think that's a very appropriate role for government to make sure that when women are making their own personal choices about their reproductive health, that they are dealing with doctors and nurses who are qualified and facilities that are safe. But this, as you say, does have the potential of going way over the line here with handicapped parking spaces, like I said before, and very wide wide hallways and stuff like that that would shut down abortion clinics.
Yeah, this was not a bill based on any evidence or any scientific inquiry or any kind of medical expertise. And in fact, the Board of Health regulates all of these things and has regulated
already.
And it didn't see any need to regulate it. Yeah. But the General Assembly is now imposing it on them.
Yes, and I don't think that the legislators who were involved with this make any bones about the fact that this is an anti-abortion push.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, right. I don't think any. Yeah. This isn't something that we're just ascribing to them. Yeah, they're very clear about that. Well, I know that the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia is going to have an event on May the 21st regarding these threats to reproductive rights in Virginia. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
This is actually our annual membership meeting, and we are bringing down a woman, Elizabeth Nash, from the Guttmacher Institute, which is a national organization that probably deals in the most sophisticated ways with what's going on in terms of reproductive rights. And she's going to talk about what's going on in Virginia, but also give us a sense of how the landscape is shifting in other states as well. What's happening in Virginia is happening in a lot of places. There's a very strong movement, the strongest movement in years, to cut back on reproductive rights through these sort of side doors. So I think that she's going to be very interesting to listen to, and I think we're going to learn a lot from her about what we can do.
And that takes place on May the 21st from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Friends Meeting House, 4500 Kensington Avenue. For our listeners, if you're driving and you don't have time to jot all of this information down, not to worry. We will post it on our blog shortly after the show, indiemedialive.blogspot.com. As we are moving into our last few minutes, it's 6 minutes before the hour on Indie Media Live, I'm talking with Kent Willis, the executive director of the ACLU of Virginia. Kent, could you bring us up to date on the case out of Prince William County about the filtering of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered websites through the school board?
Yeah, this is an issue that the ACLU is working on, not only in Virginia, but across the nation. We have something called Don't Filter Me, and this came out of information we discovered that a lot of school systems are filtering out access to lesbian and gay websites on their school computers. And as we know, schools have a right to confine what you do on the computers that belong to them. Student-issued computers and school computers are going to have filtering systems of some kind. But what we discovered is that many of the schools across the country are specifically filtering out any access to information about that gays and lesbian students may want to access. There are a couple of problems here. One is free speech. You have a right to access this information just like you have a right to access information about Republicans or Democrats or almost any viewpoint. The other is something called the Equal Access Law, and that's a federal law passed in the 1990s that said if you're going to have school groups, those school groups, first of all, have a right to organize based on their viewpoint without discrimination, and they have the same right to access information as other groups. And this was put in place to prevent schools from discriminating against clubs that they didn't particularly like. So if you have a young Democrats, you can have a young Republicans, you can have a German club, a Latin club, you can even have religion clubs, and you can't say only Christian clubs, you have to allow all religion clubs. And if a student group wants to get together and form a student club related to gay and lesbian rights, they have a right to do that, and they have a right to access the same kind of information that other clubs do. If you belong to the Key Club or the German Club, you can go online and find out how to organize, but if you're in Prince William and you are looking to form, say, a student LGBT club, that information is blocked. Another piece of information that's interesting here is we discovered that while the school blocked access to gay and lesbian rights websites. They did not block access to websites that one might call anti-gay or lesbian. As you probably know, there are lots of websites out there that are, you know, you shouldn't be gay or it's bad to be gay, that sort of thing. And those websites you actually can access. So we wrote Prince William and said, fix this or else. And that's kind of where we are. They wrote back and said, give us some time to look into what's going on. And so we've given them a couple of weeks to do that, and we will see what sort of response. The only legal response they can give is to allow access to take the filter off. But we, you know, they could come up with something creative. So we have a few more days before we know exactly what they're going to do.
Well, Kent Willis, Executive Director of the Virginia's ACLU, thank you so much for being here and for bringing us up to date on these really important constitutional issues. I hope you'll come back soon and give us another update on what you and your organization are up to. ACLUVA.org, if you want to find out about what is going on with the ACLU, and if you want to find out about how to join the ACLU, that is the place to do that. And May the 21st from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Friends Meeting House, 4500 Kensington Avenue, the emerging threats to reproductive rights in Virginia and beyond. Kent, thank you so much, and thank you for all of your support throughout the years of community radio.
Thank you so much.
On behalf of all the wonderful volunteers at WRIR, thank you to everyone for listening. Until next week, when my guest will be Jennifer McClellan, the delegate from the 71st District, Richmond's own Jennifer McClellan, I hope that you will be kind to yourselves, kind to each other, and kind to the animals and to the planet. But don't be silent, because silence is the voice of complicity. We wish you peace.